Hello everyone. This is the first of the audio lectures. I think one of the following ones will actually also say that, but we're a little bit behind, so I'm shifting things a little bit. And that means these are probably the first audio lectures you're going to hear. Now, I'm making a guess here a little bit that we're starting roughly at slide 20 of the early Cold War PowerPoint. So that's where you should get to, is slide 20, which actually says for multilateralism. What we're talking about here is the basic outline of the Cold War, the basic structure of the Cold War, and the key elements. And I think I'm going to get up through number one, number two, and number three actually in class. So we're going to start with number four. And again, as I do all these lectures, I'll be referring to the slide number. That way you'll have something visual to go along with the audio, as if we were in class and I was showing you PowerPoint and discussing various things. You should also use the review sheet as well. That'll be important. Keep the review sheet out, because there will be terms that normally I would write on the board or write on the Microsoft Word file that I have sitting up on the screen when I switch back and forth from something I'm writing to a PowerPoint slide. All those terms that I'll talk about when I'm doing the audio lecture, you'll see most of them. You see all of the terms that are relevant show up in the review sheet. So you can take a look at that. So I'll discuss a key term and you'll know which terms are important because they'll be on the review sheet. So your PowerPoint, the audio lecture, and the review sheet, those are the three things you need. And of course, take notes as if we were in class. So we're starting on slide 20. We have six different things, which are elements of the early Cold War. And actually, if you go back to, let's see, slide number nine, that lists these six things. We, in theory, have gotten through one, two, and three in class, in lecture, and we're going to start with number four in the audio lectures. All right, and that's slide 20. So what we're talking about here is the fourth element, and this is pretty easy, brief to get through, multilateralism. During the Cold War, the United States tried to build alliances. What it felt it should do as a goal would be to gather as many nations in the world to ally with the United States, and it's all part of the balance of power. The more countries that are on the United States side of the balance of power, the stronger the United States will be, the fewer countries on the Soviet side, the stronger the United States will be. So we're always trying to get countries to join alliances, and we liked in most cases to do formal alliances. Now, the list that you see on slide 20, you don't necessarily have to write them all down. NATO is the only one that I think would be important, and we'll bring that back up. But these are some links to either the actual alliance itself, which is still around. NATO is still around. Of course, the United Nations is still around. CENTO is gone, CETO is gone, ANZUS is sort of semi-crumbling, but trying to piece it back together. But the idea was that the United States would get together with allies and create formal alliances, alliances that had rules and regulations. Take NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The purpose of NATO was to create the command structure for World War III. Right? World War III hadn't happened. And everyone was hoping that you wouldn't have World War III, but you actually created the command structure. You created a decision-making structure for the United States to defend Europe along with its NATO allies. When you think of NATO allies, we're talking about Western European nations, all of the Western democracies, France and West Germany, and England, and the Netherlands, and Belgium, and Norway, and actually Turkey was in it as well, and Spain and Portugal, Iceland, Canada, the United States, all of them together, and NATO actually expanded as time went on, to create a political decision-making structure and a military command structure so that if the Soviets ever invaded, you're already ready. You don't have to build the alliance. You don't have to decide who's in it. You don't have to try to figure out how do we make a decision when the Soviets invade. It's all done as part of the NATO treaty. Nations sign on. Well, that's their agreement to say, we are with the United States, we are with the West, we are defending Europe, and here is the way that we do it. And actually, that allowed the United States and the other countries of NATO to actually deploy military forces in Western Europe to defend it. So all throughout Germany, France had troops in the rear lines at times to defend France. You had Belgian troops and Norwegian troops and Canadian troops all lined up, getting ready to defend against a potential Soviet attack. And I believe if you click on that deployment link, let me see if that still works. I hope it does. Nope, it's gone. I will have to try to find that. But actually, it was a map of military deployments in Western Europe. So troops were sent, and you had hundreds of thousands of troops by the mid-1960s in Western Europe, ready, just active out there in the field, ready for a possible Soviet invasion. So NATO was there. I may have talked about NATO earlier, but this is a good point to bring it back up, just in case. The United States, ultimately, by the 1980s, actually had over 300,000 troops in Europe ready to fight World War III. The Central Treaty Organization was an old one from the 1950s of the United States and some Middle Eastern allies. Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, CETO, was an organization created by the United States to help defend South Vietnam. ANZUS, obviously, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. And of course, the biggest of all of them, the United Nations. And the United States tried to use the United Nations as a way to fight the Cold War. So multilateralism, pretty basic, no need to go too deeply into it. Let's move on to the fifth aspect of the early Cold War, regional conflict. Well, this one is a little bit more interesting, a little bit more complex. If you take a look at this map on slide 21, what you see is that red and blue version of the world. All right, the idea that the world is bipolar, and the dark blue is the United States, the light blue are U.S. allies, the red is the Soviet Union, and China and Mongolia are in yellow, and then the Soviet allies are the lighter red. Now, the idea there is that the United States and the Soviet Union are competing in the world. Both countries want to expand their influence around the world, but both of them have what were called spheres of influence, parts of the world that they believed are theirs. The United States' sphere of influence was Latin America. I should say Central and South America, Mexico, all the light blue states south of the United States, that was the United States' sphere of influence. We basically said to Soviets, you don't touch this. This is ours, leave it alone. Western Europe, also, we said, that is ours. Not our sphere of influence, but those are our core allies. The Soviets' sphere of influence was Eastern Europe. Much smaller than what the United States had in allies, but you're looking at those states just westward of the Soviet border, of Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, those states, that's the Soviet sphere of influence. The United States made it clear over and over and over again, if you muck around in our sphere of influence, you risk World War III. The Soviets said pretty clearly, if you muck around in our sphere of influence, you risk World War III. Now, Cuba is a kind of an exception. If you look at that Western Hemisphere, you see a little yellow state in there. That's Cuba. But if you think about what happened with Cuba, the United States tried to overthrow Fidel Castro in 1961 and failed. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, in which the Soviets put nuclear weapons in Cuba, and the United States basically said, you want World War III? You've got it. And the Soviets backed out of it. Now, a little bit later on, I'm going to discuss the Cuban Missile Crisis in some more detail. So hold that thought. But the big picture is when the Soviets challenged the United States in our sphere of influence, we basically said, are you ready for nuclear war? As it turns out, though, we didn't overthrow Cuba because we felt trying to overthrow Cuba could lead to nuclear war. So we essentially said, we'll leave Cuba alone. We'll stop trying to overthrow Fidel Castro, but we will isolate it. We will treat it like a pariah. We will not allow it to be part of anything related to the Western Hemisphere, any organizations. We will not trade with it. And the United States maintained that embargo, political and economic embargo on Cuba from the time that Fidel Castro took power in 1959 until the Obama administration. So talk about holding a grudge. The Cold War ended in the early 1990s, but the isolation of Cuba continued on. So that's what happens when you challenge the sphere of influence. Though Cuba is a little bit unique. If you look over on the other side at Eastern Europe, when the Soviets mucked around in Eastern Europe trying to reestablish communist states that were weakening, when you had strikes in East Germany in 1953, a protest movement that actually was critical of communism, the Soviet Union crushed it. The West did nothing. 1956, the Soviet Union invaded Hungary because of a reform movement. The West did nothing. 1968, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia because of a reform movement there. The West did nothing, because the understanding was that is the Soviet sphere of influence, and if we start fooling around there, it could be World War III. So the risk was simply too great. Just too great. Now, the point, though, of this is look at the gray parts. Africa, the Middle East, and a lot of South Asia and Southeast Asia. The gray parts, well, those are parts of the world that are essentially up for grabs. There's conflict there, and the United States and the Soviet Union are saying, all right, we want to take those gray states, and we want to change them to be our allies. So the United States is trying to get gray states to be an ally of the United States, essentially turn them blue. The Soviets are trying to get those gray states to be allies of the Soviet Union, essentially turn them some shade of red or yellow, depending on how you design this map. But that was the goal. And so what they would do is they would say, we're going to ally ourselves with a... Let me back up for a second, excuse me. The United States would say, we're going to ally ourselves with an anti-communist group in a country or a region and give them money and give them weapons so they can fight the Cold War. And the Soviets would ally themselves with a communist group in a nation or a region and give them money and weapons to fight the Cold War. And what you got were regional conflicts. Now, specifically, move on to slide 22, and here you've got an example of it. So think about the Arab-Israeli conflict, right, in the Middle East. The United States backed Israel. The Soviets, for up until the early 1970s, backed Syria, Egypt, and the PLO. So you might think of that as a war related to the Middle East, but it also became a part of the Cold War. And actually, what's interesting about that is Egypt changed sides in the mid-1970s. So you had Israel and Egypt versus Syria and the PLO and some other states in there. Though Egypt really didn't fight Syria, it just made peace with Israel and sort of was somewhat neutral in that sense. That was a big victory for the United States to get Egypt out of that regional conflict. But before that, the United States funneled Israel with weapons in Syria and Egypt and PLO. Even if you go to the 1973 war in which Syria and Egypt attacked Israel, that was a case in which you had about a two-week war in which the United States was just pumping weapons into Israel to keep Israel alive and to keep Israel able to fight. On the other hand, the Soviets were pumping Syria and Egypt with weapons to keep those two alive and ready and continuing to fight. The PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, is actually an umbrella group of Palestinian nationalist groups, groups that were trying to create an independent Palestine, but they were also Marxist and allied with the Soviet Union. So it wasn't just about independence for Palestine. If there had been an independent Palestine during the Cold War, it would have been allied with the Soviet Union, which is why the United States opposed it, which is why the United States had Israel oppose, actually Israel never negotiate with the PLO until the Cold War actually ended. So even that terrorist aspect and early part of terrorism was related to the Cold War. In fact, during the Cold War, almost all terrorism was sponsored by the Soviet Union because almost all the terrorism in the world was actually leftist, Marxist. So Israel versus Syria in Egypt and the PLO, that was one aspect of it. Ethiopia versus Somalia in the 1970s was another aspect. Cold War on the Horn of Africa. That one was also kind of weird because actually in the mid-1970s, the Ethiopian regime that was allied with the United States was overthrown. And it was overthrown by a Marxist group. and it had been an American-backed Ethiopia versus a Soviet-backed Somalia, but now the Soviets had a choice. You have a Marxist movement in Ethiopia, and you also have a socialist movement in Somalia, and the Soviets actually switched sides to Ethiopia. Ethiopia broke its alliance with the United States. Somalia then turned around and said, well, the Soviets have abandoned us, and then they said, oh, we're not Marxists, and they allied with the United States. So very, very bizarre, and the result of that was actually Ethiopia and Somalia going to war in 1977 and 78, and both sides were fighting with U.S. and Soviet weapons. So very, very bizarre. Taiwan and China, you'll get more detail on this a little bit later. But 1946 to 1949, there was a civil war in China. You had the old government, the Republic of China, which was an anti-communist group. You may have heard about the nationalist movement in China. Well, the Nationalist Party was the political organization that controlled China from the late 1920s until the Japanese invasion, and then they were the group that was fighting Japan, and Chiang Kai-shek, their leader, was part of the Western Alliance during World War II. But when the war ended, the nationalist movement, allied with the United States, was challenged by a communist movement backed by the Soviet Union. And you had a civil war, nationalists versus communists, from 1946 to 1949, and the communists won. The nationalists fled to a small island, Taiwan, and you'll read about this, and again, in a little bit of later lecture, we'll talk more about this, but just think of it this way. The nationalists fled to a small island called Taiwan off the coast of China, and there they were protected by the United States. The United States considered that Taiwan to be the real China, while the Soviets considered the communist regime, which controlled the large mainland, to be the actual China. But you had a Cold War there. The United States had a China ally, the Soviets had a China ally. Of course, South Korea and North Korea, that was a case where the United States and the Soviet Union simply cut the country in half, and then there wound up being a war from 1950 to 1953. South Vietnam and North Vietnam. The United States backed South Vietnam, Soviets backed North Vietnam. Again, same type of communist versus anti-communist struggle, in which both sides are pumping money and weapons. And from 1956 to 1975, you had various wars going on between South Vietnam and North Vietnam. The United States, of course, gets involved in that war. We'll talk a little bit about Korea and Vietnam. You'll hear about that a little bit later. Another example would be Angola, for instance, in which you've got a country which is about to gain independence. In the 1970s, it had been colonized by the Portuguese. It's about to gain independence. And the question is, who's going to lead the country after independence? Well, there are a bunch of different groups. There are anti-communist groups, the FNLA and also UNITA, anti-communist groups, and the MPLA, which was a Marxist group. So they begin a large civil war in the 1970s, which continues on into the 1980s and to a certain extent even beyond that. But they begin a civil war during the Cold War, and of course the Soviets backed the MPLA, the United States backed at one point the FNLA, and then later on backed UNITA. So that's the way the game was played. You find your ally, you pump them with money and weapons, and you fight the Cold War on a regional basis, hoping to get those gray countries on that map to either turn blue in the U.S. case or red in the Soviet case. So you fight this, and that's the way the Cold War is played, and it continued for all the decades of the Cold War. And these are just some examples of it. There are more examples. You can pick regions and other countries and describe Cold War battles that were going on. Actually, I missed the last one. Nicaragua, Guatemala, and El Salvador, all three countries in Central America from the 1970s to the 1980s, had American-backed governments which were facing off against Soviet-backed or Marxist rebel movements that were trying to overthrow the government. And that's a sort of a broad categorization, because if you get into the details, it's a little bit more interesting. In Nicaragua, the American-backed dictator was actually overthrown by Marxists and non-Marxists the middle class, the newspaper publishers, basically a broad-based revolution that overthrew the American-backed dictator. But after that American-backed dictator was overthrown, the Marxists squeezed everybody else out, and you wound up with a Marxist government in Nicaragua after 1979. Guatemala is, kind of complex because you had a government in the early 1950s, which the United States labeled as communist, and whether it was communist is a really good question. It was certainly leftist, but it wasn't necessarily allied with the Soviet Union. That's a really iffy thing there. Didn't matter to the Eisenhower administration, and actually we talked about this a little bit earlier, which the United States helped overthrow the government, and you had this very ugly dictatorship, anti-communist dictatorship, that lasted into the 1990s and faced off against leftist rebel groups backed by the Soviet Union. El Salvador is a little bit more complex because the group that was in power was actually a dictatorship backed by the United States. The group that opposed it by the 1970s had some Marxists in it, but mostly the revolution in El Salvador in the late 70s and early 1980s was actually, actually had its roots in the Catholic Church. So it was kind of interesting in that that was different, very kind of complex. But you did have these regional conflicts, and the United States felt it was fighting the Cold War and backed anti-communist groups. Again, they didn't necessarily have to be democratic. They just had to be anti-communist. Well, stop for a second there and jump to the next slide, number 23. Regional conflict had a couple rules in it. First is no direct U.S.-Soviet conflict. Funnel money in, funnel weapons in, but don't allow the regional conflicts to become World War III. The United States and the Soviet Union were ready to fight World War III over Europe and probably over Japan, but not over Angola. Not even over Korea, not over something in Central America. So no direct U.S.-Soviet conflict. And for instance, give you an example, when the United States did intervene directly, as in Korea, for example, the Soviets were backing North Korea. China actually intervened in the war, so you had U.S. and Chinese direct conflict, but the Soviets did not intervene in any significant way. There were some actual dogfights, fighter planes attacking each other, U.S. and Soviet fighter planes, but that was kept secret. And it was very small scale, nothing major. It was kept secret to try to prevent this from getting out of hand. In some ways, people looked at these and said that was a mistake, but no direct U.S.-Soviet conflict in these regions. If the United States got involved, as in Korea and Vietnam, the Soviets did not get involved. When the Soviets moved troops when the Soviets had allies move troops into places like China moving to Korea, then the Soviets would back out. If you had a situation, for instance, Cuba sent troops to Angola, the United States did not send anything directly. So the idea was no direct conflict because you don't want Americans killing Russians because that can lead to World War III, and they're not ready to fight World War III over regional conflict. The second rule is no escalation. If you're dealing with a war in Angola, if you're dealing with a war in the Middle East, if you're dealing with a war in Korea or Vietnam, don't allow that war to expand to other countries. Because if it expands to other countries, you also have the possibility of World War III. So you don't allow that to happen. Give an example. I'm going to back off for a second. We'll talk about that example a little bit later. So no direct U.S.-Soviet conflict, no escalation. And if we were in class, I would say, why did you have those rules? They weren't written down, but they were understood. So why do you have these informal rules? And the answer is pretty simple. It's really on the next slide, actually. The answer is pretty simple. It's nuclear weapons. Is you don't want any of this to expand to World War III because World War III is fought with nuclear weapons. And that changes the whole game, and that's just too dangerous to allow to be happening. All right, I'm going to stop here, and we're going to talk about deterrence and forward presence, number 6, in the next audio lecture.